Buenos dias, welcome to Eco Village Library. I am Christopher Kinney. I am the creator of Eco Village Library and your host for today. For this episode, I want to focus in on the dynamics between urbanization, rural to urban migration, and how do we regenerate local economies? This has been on my mind for these past couple days, and well, I figured I'd just talk about it here and see what you all think. And also stick to the end because did some research on pre-colonialist East African people and how they lived, and the answer would not be what you may think it is. So stay tuned till the end, and as always, please leave a review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. And finally, at the very end, I will discuss what actions you and I can take together to help create a local economy or a local economy network. So stay tuned. I hope you enjoy. Well, I'll just go ahead and dive right in. And I'll start with a memory I've had from one of my most recent trips to Portugal, to the countryside. I love going to Portugal. I've learned a lot. And a realization really made itself clear through my time traveling, which was everything's abandoned. No one's there. I'm always asking myself, where is everybody? A lot of the people who are there are a lot of the older folk. And I remember catching myself with a conversation with some very old guy, could barely understand his Portuguese. He was about in his 80s. And I told him, or asked him, where is everybody? And, and this was right outside of a primary school, which was boarded up, just no life inside. The building was abandoned, as felt like the rest of the town. And, and it is very hard to understand Portuguese. He was telling me that everyone's gone to the cities, everyone's moved on. Everyone's abandoned these small towns. There's more jobs, there's more opportunity in the huge conglomerations of the cities. Everyone went to Lisboa, he would say. Or everyone went to Porto, he would say. And I'm like, damn, who doesn't want to come back to these towns now? Now we're in the age of telecommunication, and ever more so in the situation we're in. Everyone's got the capability to work disconnected or physically disconnected, but still more connected than ever before. And so my biggest question was, how has this happened in the first place? What are the dynamics behind this? Why has urbanization and the concentration of cities, their rural to urban migration, has been accentuated with every passing year? What's the dynamics behind that? And second of all, why wouldn't we want to go back to these small towns and repopulate the countryside where quality of life is way much better, more nature around, you can hear more of the birds instead of just the honking of cars and, people screaming at each other in the streets, So that's always been a question in the back of my mind since then, and I've seen this trend almost everywhere else I've gone to as well. But let's get into this a little bit more deeply and kind of get to the grain of it. And this is just going to be talking about what I've come to understand as the ruling dynamics and what could be done. So I decided to call this episode Towards a Village Economy because I feel like it's more of a question, a socioeconomic question or problem to be solved. If you wanted to look at it as a problem to be solved. And I do personally see it as a problem due to all the negative consequences of urbanization. It would be a different story if urbanization was happening in a way of which wasn't so catastrophic to not only the ecology, the environment, but also to the people who live in those cities. For me, when I live in the cities, boy, I just do not have a good time. And I always come across myself feeling fight or flight all the time. Well, let's get into this. So the trades and skills which have always existed in small village environments have, in many cases, been lost and forgotten because now there's no one to learn them. Now everyone's been modernized and, all in the same boat, and who knows where this boat is going. And so as such, the demand for very simple tools and equipment have also been in the decline too, being substituted with the production of mass-produced goods, imported goods. And so when we look at this as rural development and successful rural development, I think it requires the development of these, or rediscovery of these small-scale ways of being, these small-scale, small-village skill sets to be rediscovered and reutilized and reestablish village-based productive industries, and also focusing everything onto the agricultural sector, which has always historically been the economic backbone of the small towns and the countryside. But who knows now with the digital age where everything's on a level playing field, more or less. So now, analyzing this onset of urbanization or modernization or industrialization, whichever way you want to look at it, they're all in one of the same. This, in effect, of the rural parts of the world, and particularly that of the third world, has often been seen always as progress, you know, by the modern economists of our time, the strategists, politicians, whatever. They've always seen this as progress. Some third world agricultural country is industrializing, quote unquote, so therefore they are progressing. But are they really? Well, it's undeniable that most forms of rural and third world industrialization has often led to a general dependency on foreign multinational industrial capital, and thus plunging into debt with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, or I've heard this acronym described as others as the International Mafia Federation, or I'm fucked, whichever way you want to look at it. Thus, these countries are thrown into debt with the IMF, which has ended up just sucking out all the community resources from the countryside and into the urban areas, of which within these urban areas, you see the divide between the rich and the poor to be accentuated day by day. And well, this still persists today in varying degrees across the world, but there is an alternative, and that's why I want to make this episode, because the alternative that I'm suggesting, as inspired by the research I've done, what I've read, listened to, and just looking at this thing as objectively as I possibly can, although I still have to confess I do have my subjective view, perspective, and opinions on this. What I see is that this alternative could still allow industrialization, or maybe a better word to use, economic progress, but allow this to develop and benefit small rural communities. And here, what I'm referring to is appropriate technology. A small-scale technology which uses locally available raw materials, and it's affordable by the locals, and it's decentralized, energy efficient, environmentally sound, and locally autonomous. With this appropriate technology, this will minimize imported goods, will minimize the need for imported goods, and use existing indigenous skills. The use of this appropriate technology leverages labor more so than capital, and when you lack the means financially, this, I think, is a very viable solution. It wakes up the innovation and the creativity of the human soul. In any situation, the local resources will eventually determine the possibilities. And unless technical innovation can come from the people themselves, there is no such thing as an appropriate technology, because only the people themselves can decide on what's appropriate. And so I'm in love with this concept because it connects the human spirit with innovation, with whatever needs there are for any given situation, which could be different all across the board. And just kind of seems like life. There's just not one cookie cutter solution. So when we look at this alternative in respects to community development and developing small industry, a rural community development program like this needs to be executed by the people themselves in order to be a true community development and thereby have true success. Now, what does success really mean in this conversation? Well, let's take a quick glance at the situation or problem that will show us where to look for the solution. And the situation is this. There is an incredible and ever-expanding rural to urban migration pattern that seems to be the result of the dynamics of our current globalized economic paradigm. The United Nations defines this urbanization pattern as a shift in a population from that is dispersed across small rural settlements in which agriculture is the dominant economic activity, towards one that is concentrated in larger and denser urban settlements characterized by a dominance of industrial and service activities. Now, here are some crazy numbers to throw this whole thing into perspective. Now, listen. By 2018, North America was the most urbanized region in the world with, guess it, 82% of its population living in urban areas. In Latin America and the Caribbean, it's 81%. Europe, 74%. Asia, 50%. And Africa, 43%. And this trend continues strongly into the next decade, where the average urbanized population is expected to increase from an average of 55% to 60% by 2030. Now, is this all a good thing or a bad thing? You know, these are just statistics. They're neutral by themselves. But as we analyze quality of life, living the good life, what do you think? Is it good or bad? I don't know. What makes something good and what makes something bad seems to be all about perspective, you know? And, well, this situation is incredibly complex. And obviously, a lot ultimately depends on the city itself and what the ecological footprint ends up calculating out to be per capita versus the per capita average, if you want to compare using those apples. So, for example, in the city of Denver, where I'm originally from, residents have a slightly higher carbon footprint versus the national average due to the need of heating homes during winter in a city that is sprawled out, which has become ever more sprawled out since moving away from Denver, which has appeared very much like LA. And New York City, believe it or not, ends up having a carbon footprint 30% lower than the national average. So you can quickly see that this good versus bad argument gets wonky very quickly. However, I will just say that for me personally, I can't stand living within a city environment. I just go crazy. You know, like I said, I feel like my fight or flight responses just come up much more frequently when I'm navigating any major urban area. And from a risk assessment lens, strategic analyst Joel Skousen stresses in his book, Strategic Relocation, that the biggest risk, even a bigger risk than being a victim of a nuclear war, for example, for any individual in the 21st century now is population density. And when you compare these statistics, they are certainly not as wonky when you compare the correlations between crime and violence and population density. So whenever I find myself talking about the good life, I always get the image of a slow-paced environment of a well-intentioned eco-village community where everyone knows each other and can work their differences out. And now, with the experiences I've had up to this point, I completely feel that intuitively. And I can definitely attest to this, the more that I've experienced being in such eco-village communities and being with agricultural family farms and what it just feels like. It just feels great. It feels just the way life should be. And until, you know, I have to go return to the city for whatever reason and just hits me like a sack of potatoes across the face. Like, man, all right, I know clearly, at least for me, where I need to be, how I need to be living. And so, again, please remember that this is just my own opinion and my own perspective. And, you know, I believe that everyone must think for themselves and ultimately arrive at their own conclusions. Now, with all that being said and swinging back to discussing solutions, successful rural development, as I see, is more of an emancipation from the need to have to move to the city, which has so far destroyed rural life around the world and just the traditional backbone of many peoples, you know, especially the indigenous of Brazil, for example, of any country where they have no choice but to move to the city for various reasons, some of the extreme being that, you know, their homeland got burnt down by the government themselves and so they had to move into the city and live in illegal settlements or whatnot, you know, just things like that. And because the small town, rural way of living is being destroyed in many parts of the world. And now a lot of towns are now empty with no life, like I saw in Portugal and many other parts of the world. So why is everybody moving to the cities then? Well, that's where you'll have the best chances to make some currency notes. And what if you don't have to work any longer for these currency notes? Would you still go to the city and leave your culture behind? I know I wouldn't. So how can we redevelop the rural sector and bring life back to the countryside and have town gatherings with all the generations present, you know? Despite whatever political differences that are amongst rural development programs, they all contain largely the same elements, which would indicate that despite ideologies, certain elements are believed to be essential for rural development, such as agricultural programs, schools, health services, technical training, home management, and childcare. So now, what may vary is the integration amongst all these essential factors, but when we strive to improve rural life and village industry, there are two main obstacles to overcome. One, capital accumulation. For example, the income of the common villager is often so low that they simply cannot afford machines, fertilizer, etc. Neither pay for experts to come in. And the second obstacle, and perhaps the most important, is knowledge. Access to knowledge, obtaining knowledge, learning all that there is to know or what's appropriate. You simply cannot create an autonomous village industry or have it come out to resurgence or from out of nowhere without knowledge. Knowledge is the backbone. So a good strategy I see is that instead of relying on investment from the outside, why not learn to develop the necessary skills through a gradual training process while contributing to some kind of production at the same time? In today's world, where nearly the whole global population has access to free information, now is the time. So let's say you and I wanted to go learn how to grow hemp and build homes with it, for example. But, you know, we have the slightest idea on how to do it properly. So where do we begin? Well, we're on the land and we have connections to the World Wide Web. I would personally, seek out the best in the field and do whatever it takes to be personally trained by whatever experts I find. Second best is to consult books, papers, videos, while we just get the ball rolling and start doing it, you know? Learn as you go. And obviously, there will be a lot of mistakes made during the process, but hey, that's how we build up our skill sets. Failures are always ultimately the greatest successes, if and only if you still keep on going after those failures. Eventually, we'll go through one home and learn just a shit ton of mistakes and know what doesn't work. And then that will progress to another home, to maybe 5 homes, to 20 homes. And then by the 20 home mark, I can guarantee you that we will have it down way much better than the first home that we've went at it without any prior experience or knowledge. So where has this all gone wrong in the past in regards to rural development and regenerating a local economy? Well, what I've seen, the focus on exporting, you know, developing whatever to export it away. You know, I definitely saw this in Latin America. For example, I spent quite a bit of time in Colombia, in one of the best coffee producing regions of the world. But, you know, there was no good coffee to be found just being out and about, you know, within the communities I was living in. Why? Because these communities depended on income from faraway clients for their community development. And so they had to sell away the best coffee they had. So the best of what they were producing was being exported away. And maybe some of the income coming back in were just being held up in the hands of some of the wealthiest and nobody else getting a share of that. And I know this is not an easy thing either to get passed by. And I'm perfectly aware of the socioeconomic polarities that make it damn right difficult for any region to just simply not rely on any export-import relationships they may currently have. But now this leads me to ask, what if we redefined wealth in broader terms versus defining our wealth by paper or digital notes under our name? Or in other words, future promises of wealth, of which that's all currency is anyway, essentially an IOU. So what if we redefine the wealth of a community or a village as, well, the sum total resources at the disposal of the whole community versus the sum of just individual accumulations. And what's the vehicle that will bring us there? Well, I believe it's education, learning, learning while doing, while learning to produce. And education should be a constant activity for all, and training should be production-oriented. For example, the way I have personally learned permaculture design, natural building, engineering design, and growing fruit has all been while I was actively producing or engaged in that particular skill set. So like the first time I learned how to build with hemp, for example, in Colorado, the result ended up being a tiny home for a small family in Colorado. So we were productive, but it was also an educative event, workshop, where everybody, it was a win-win situation. We learned and we produced. Learning this way in community will generate such knowledge and energy to reinforce the economic backbone while addressing the immediate needs. So imagine what this model will look like perpetuated across all the rural sectors. So through learning by doing and learning to produce, some of the key areas to this as part of a successful rural development program is by developing agriculture, like through infrastructural works and providing agricultural tools, substituting the import of consumer goods, and manufacturing the means of production for processing agricultural products. But enough of just speaking in these broad terms now. What has this looked like before? And this question has led me to the author and economic historian Roger Van Zwavenberg, who wrote a very interesting piece several decades ago called Pre-Colonialist Industry in East Africa. And boy, it was fascinating. So let me tell you a little bit about this one, because here's what he had to say that I thought very interesting. So the first thing that jumped out at me was his conclusion that, generally speaking, pre-colonialist East Africans have not appeared to be exactly self-sufficient before the colonial economy. So let me repeat that. The pre-colonialist East Africans apparently have not appeared to this economic historian as self-sufficient communities before the colonialists arrived and changed up the whole paradigm. Yeah, I was quite shocked actually to read this because, well, I've always been under the impression that before colonialism exercised its brass knuckles and, you know, did what it did, I thought all tribal communities, you know, lived on their own terms. Well, this was not totally the case in East Africa, and thus, I guess, other parts of the world, because, well, mostly everyone during that time certainly, well, they did provide most of their food needs for most of the years, and especially when rainfall was sufficient. But when it wasn't, hardly anybody was able to provide for themselves, and especially when the rains failed for more than a year. So as a result, nearly everybody established patterns of trade, friendship, and kinship relations with people in the nearby vicinity where there was no ethnic connection, but the people had a different means of production and other goods. This, he said, ended up providing two different advantages. One, they provided a regular mutual exchange of goods, not otherwise regularly available. And two, they formed a social bond, which could mean the difference between life and death and years of drought and famine. So Rogers' research further showed that most areas produced a particular commodity according to its particular resources available. So, for example, like one area specialized in a salt, which was a sweet tasting salt, for example. And a second area was all about iron hoes. A third area was all about fish traps. A fourth one of, you know, making poison for arrowheads. And a fifth one of, you know, shields from buffalo hides, while others might have produced rough cotton material and so on. So nearly every localized area seemed to have produced something unique and special, almost always being agriculturally related. So what does this all reveal then? Well, at least historically for this region, nearly all the different communities depended on each other for everyday consumer goods, providing a strong indication that the predominant paradigm was the following: a localized economic interdependence based upon localized manufacturing skills, based upon the character of the local resources available. So let's pull back now, back to our present day, shifting directions here, and, well, shifting directions and paradigms. So how can we shift back to something like this, which now, in my opinion, seems to be our default way of operating, living, dealing with one another? This, I think, here is the quadrillion-dollar question. But why not start opening up this giant barrel of worms right now, right here? Let's just see what we find. So, you know, we could see that it's undeniable that it, literally every economy in the world today has been induced into a single, highly centralized economy, which depends on vast and large homogenized markets and increasing trade. This economic paradigm has been spreading alongside globalization, where more and more governments around the world are subsidizing the physical infrastructure and also restructuring the law and trade rules environment to help facilitate this spread, thus giving us these obnoxious cities with their obnoxious rules and so on and so forth. So what can we do about all this if we wanted to bring back our original way of life, if you want to look at it that way? Helena Norberg-Hodge is the founder and director of Local Futures, and she has beautifully outlined some of the most essential steps we can take together in shifting from economic globalization to this economic localization paradigm. Such steps, she says, would set us up on the road to economic and environmental health, stem the unhealthy tide of urbanization, and support cultural diversity. And this whole shift would end up being far less costly to the taxpayer than what is currently being burdened upon each and every one by our current globalizing path. And she says an immediate and personal action that you and I can take to embrace this path is to reinstall a deep sense of connection with the place where we live and to recognize or rediscover the deep psychological benefits and all the joy of living in community. This means reconnecting with the sources of our food, perhaps even growing some of our own, and learning to appreciate the cycles of seasons and the characteristics of the flora and the fauna. Ultimately, this involves a spiritual awakening, which comes from making a connection with others and with nature. It requires us to see the world within us, to experience more consciously the great interdependent web of life, which we ourselves are a part. Helena also mentions that rather than just thinking in terms of isolated and scattered grassroots efforts, that we also remain conscious of the governmental policies that will also help facilitate such growth to take place and to support such efforts that will allow this space for more community-based economies to flourish and spread. This includes supporting decentralized renewable energy infrastructures, which will end up strengthening villages, smaller towns, and rural economies, and thereby halting the horrific urbanizing process. Or also just recognizing and removing the regulatory burdens placed upon small-scale enterprises, which were originally aimed at problems caused by, well, the large-scale production in the first place. But ultimately, the creation of this new society begins with you. It begins with me. It begins with all of us. Because the world that we live in today was also created by you and by me. And so the message rings true from Mahatma Gandhi, echoing through time, that you and I must be the change that we envision and that desire to bring into reality. Well, that is all I got for this, and I'm going to leave you with that. I hope you enjoyed it, and let me know what you think. Do you agree? Do you disagree? I love to hear your thoughts. Please reach out, and let's chat. Until next time, ciao, ciao.